Evening, everybody. So one of the things I've always appreciated about our practice, you can turn off the subtitles if you want, is that we take on these different responsibilities and ringing bells and giving talks and sitting here and there and serving on boards and whatnot. And we try to kind of notice that there's this opportunity to do activities differently than our usual striving way, where we're trying to do everything perfectly and, not make any mistakes no matter what, or it shows that we're a bad person and so on, just showing up and doing our best, right? So Karen couldn't have done that wrong, but that was awesome. Great job, Karen. Really sounded good. And if you'd like to take a stab at that, Talos has put together a little instrument kit, so he will even deliver it to you, I understand. And we're working on training materials, and several people will be happy to practice with you on Zoom. So just let Bob Penny, the Eno, know, or Kate's pretty involved in this, Chris Burkhart, myself. It's fun to have new voices, Well, let's dive back into a little mix of brain science and Buddhist psychology. Tonight, mostly brain science, but this brain science, I realized, has some really important implications for us in our bodhisattva aspiration. Our bodhisattva work. In the third lesson, lesson number three of 7.5 lessons on a brain, Dr. Barrett talks about how young brains develop according to this more current neuroscience, which he has kindly, I'm sure, greatly simplified for us. But I really have a lot of faith that what she's saying is very accurate to the field of the to the scientific field, really current. So, one thing it is that it turns out that the old nature versus nurture idea in development of humans, this huge idea that we hear all the time, is it your genetics? Is it your environment? Is it your nature? Is it how you're nurtured? Nature versus nurture. Turns out that idea doesn't really make sense anymore from the perspective of modern neuroscience. The ideas implied by nature and nurture are off from reality, she says. In terms of nature, genes don't work the way we're assuming they do when we say stuff like that. They aren't like this fixed blueprint that sets you on a very particular developmental direction from birth or from conception. Genes are important for sure, they regulate the creation of cells and so on, and what kind of cells and how many and all this. And we each have our own unique combination of genetic material from our parents and so on. But genes are not like blueprints in that how they express and how they influence development is conditional and causal and influenced by a million other factors, many of them environmental. And it's not even all your genes. Some of you know our Sangha sister Lee Nelson, who's also a researcher in human development, and she's made some important discoveries that after birth, some of the mother's genetic material cruises back through the umbilical cord and affects the fetus as it's born, or maybe before, I forget. So, and in the book, she barely mentions and doesn't explain that there may also be genetic material from various microbes in us, that's also governing our development. So nature is not so simple as like that kid had that blueprint and ended up this way, and that kid had that blueprint and ended up that way. And the nurture piece isn't right either, because the idea is implied from nurture in nature versus nurture are just like way too small, not nearly big enough. And how we're nurtured and we learn in this book is not just a kind of a psychological good or bad influences or culture, although certainly those are important. It turns out how we're nurtured exactly, the exact actions that happen in your nurturing actually regulate the way your actual brain develops, So nurture is huge and a much bigger topic than what it sounds like in nature versus nurture. So they're both a little off. Because it turns out the environment children grow up in doesn't just sort of affect what's sort of like inside their brains. We have this idea that there's stuff inside our brains, knowledge and skills, right? But actually, the environment and the nurturing children receive helps to govern and affect the very structure and function of the brain, And since the brain's big job is maintaining our life, maintaining a healthy allostasis, that also means that a body in which the brain doesn't get enough of the proper kind of nurturing and doesn't develop right leads to a body that doesn't develop right either. They're not separate at all. And a little sidebar here, because I think we have all these persistent beliefs that I'm learning. Maybe you agree with me, or maybe you're learning too, or maybe you already knew, but all these beliefs about what our brain is and how it works and how the mind works, and a lot of them are wrong, So how is it's hard to even know all the ways that affects how we think, how we interact, how we perceive ourselves, how we conceive of the world. So what I was thinking here was just the idea that brains have thoughts in them, that they have contents that are separate from some sort of function and structure. That's wrong, The structure and function of the brain at this neural level, this massive network, is generating all of our experiences, Our thoughts, our memories, our perceptions, our sense of space in the body, It's all being generated by this functional network all the time, in real time. And this network is constantly changing around. It made me realize that another model we have of our brain is like a computer. She didn't even bother to refute that one. She worked on other models in the book in the earlier chapters. But sometimes we think that the brain is the hardware, and the thinking and the emotions and the culture and all that stuff is like the software. But the reality seems to be far more intertwined than that, far more rich and complex than the reality of our brain. If we were to upgrade the software, it causes the hardware to reorganize itself and rewire itself. The mouse and the computer and the keyboard and the chips all flip around and change. It's all one system and the same in the other direction. If you were to change the hardware, it changes the software. So that doesn't really work either. And the thing that's relevant for tonight is that what pops out of the uterus is not like a computer that rolls out of the factory, fully assembled and ready to boot up. Maybe it needs some software installed, learn how to be a person software. But no, it's this malleable, fluid, changing, dynamic system, cause and effect, just at a million levels. So anyway, back to baby brains. The surprising thing to me to learn, among many things here, is that baby brains start out with an even more massive network of neurons than we end up with as adults. She says about twice as many neurons. And we already end up with like something like 100, 125 billion neurons. You start with twice that in this teeny little infant brain, It's unbelievable. And it's kind of counterintuitive, that why would you start with too much? We would tend to think that you would start with less, right? You'd start with a simple network because you're small, and that you would gradually elaborate and grow more. But it turns out it works in the other direction. That this massive starter set of neural network of stuff is pruned and tuned and optimized to become an adult brain, sculpted and shaped by experience. And this tuning and pruning, this development is not automatic, like I was saying. It's not like a pre-programmed direction. I mean, there is development, there is directionality in it, but it's not a single path. because it's so responsive to the experiences the baby has. Not just what they learn, but how the brain ends up structured and how it functions. And just like, now, like we were talking about last week with neuroplasticity, that the brain can make fast or somewhat slower changes through neuronal changes in the structure as you learn new stuff. That's just going at high speed with babies. And the most important, she says, and primary experiences that are happening in this development, no surprise really, but the mechanism really kind of gives us more weight. But the most important thing that's going on is the loving, sustained, engaged contact with the baby's caregivers, with the parents, or whoever's raising the baby. And if that doesn't happen, the brain does not develop, not very well at all. So it's not automatic at all. And the other thing she reminds us about in this chapter, which is worth remembering, I think, is that we are pretty weird compared to other animals in terms of how helpless our newborns are. Right? Like horses and giraffes can walk after a couple of days. She says, pointed out, newborn chimps are strong and dexterous enough to hold on to their mama's back, you know. Brand new newborn snakes can slither along just fine, you know. But newborn humans can't do much of anything. All they can really do is wriggle towards the smell of breast milk. It's like what little ability they start with. That's it. They can't control their limbs, direct their eyesight, or do much of anything when they're born. And this is so normal to us that newborns are that way, kind of helpless, but it's just because we're used to it. It's actually like really weird, really unusual in the animal world. So it must be then that there's some kind of big advantage to this, you know. I mean, evolution is not deliberate like that, but there must be some evolutionary advantage for us to end up that way with this really slow period of development. And the advantage must have to do with having lots of time to slowly develop this brain, you know. And that there's a tremendous potential in that, having decades, depending on how you count it, 10 years, 15, 18 years, 20 years, 25, to develop our brain. It must end up with humans as really evolutionarily fit, really, really great. Because, other species have a lot of the stuff that we spend our initial years developing just baked in. But we don't have that. Instead, we have this kind of blank slate, which ends up being a very high potential system. And the potential is only actualized, though, because of other adult humans that are around. That's the only way it can be actualized. It can only be a collective social project to develop new humans, to end up with something so amazing as as me. But the thing is, there's a downside to that kind of potential and to this dependence on human society to help humans become fully humans, that it's not at birth. It's not just at birth. It's not just genetics. And the downside or the risk or the area of bodhisattva work for our culture and our society and our species is then we can get a huge amount of disparity, right? We can get very uneven amounts of this secondary development that's so critical. Some babies, as you know, get lots of great caregiving and support, and some don't. And this has a lifetime effect and a multi-generational effect. So there's a lot of potential, but there's also a lot of potential for a kind of unhappy sorting of individuals and societal groups. And sadly, as I think all of us are learning more and more clearly, and other the groups involved have known for generations and generations, a lot of that sorting happens between groups that we arbitrarily label as races. And some races, which is not a biological anything, it's a cultural idea, tend to get more and some tend to get less, right? So this is, I think, part of why this is really important to have at least the elementary school level of neuroscience this book is giving us. So the way the neurological workings happen is pretty interesting. The brain starts out, as I said, with twice as many neurons as we end up with. Massive starter set packed in there. And then experiences cause those neurons to fire up and interact in different intricate patterns that leads to what she calls tuning and pruning. Tuning and pruning. And I am trying to remember that she's massively simplifying the science, and there's probably nothing in scientific literature called tuning and pruning, but she's helping us out. And so tuning is a strengthening of connections between neurons. Neural pathways that get used a lot, and therefore must be important if they're getting used a lot, become more efficient. And as we learned last week, it's already more complicated than our brains are thinking because we're so mechanically minded. We think neuronal pathway like one pathway. Or sometimes they talk about the wiring of the brain like there are little copper wires running around. But no, this is a soupy organic system. And we learn that one particular neuron doesn't do the same thing over and over again. Different neighboring neurons take turns and they cluster and they cooperate and they trade off and they switch around, and it's very, has a lot of redundancy and complexity and what she called degeneracy in the system. But, collectively, in units, loose units of neurons, there is this increase in efficiency in parts of the brain that are getting used more. Sometimes they call this neurons that fire together, wire together. And this happens through the very structure of these neurons. It's really cool. So the neurons that are getting used more get more of this bushy stuff at the end, at each end of the little trunk-like stalk called dendrites. And at the end of those dendrites are neurotransmitters. And those neurotransmitters, remember, are the ones that secrete little neurochemicals and talk to the, and therefore through this chemical handoff, trigger their neighboring neurons. Induce a kind of a communication. We call it communication. They don't have that word for it, right? They don't have that way of thinking. But it's this intricate functioning. So there's this tuning that systems get used a lot, get more efficient, which is good, because we also remember trying to balance all the metabolic needs of this animal, that we're an animal. And if one system uses up way too much, we'll be tired all the time, we'll have to eat constantly, be unhealthy for us. So from the beginning, the brain works on how can I be more efficient? And one of those ways is tuning. The other thing that happens in the tuning, besides the richer dendrites at the end of areas that need to connect more often, is the very electrical signal runs faster and more strongly, partly because there's a kind of sheath around that central axon called myelin, like insulation. Like bark on a tree trunk that allows that electrical signal to work better. And sometimes brains have trouble with any one of these processes, and one of the ones that brains are likely to have trouble with is growing enough myelin in the right places. And if your brain has trouble with that, then you have all kinds of problems. But anyway, most of us got have it, it's fine. So that's tuning. But if the baby's brain starts out with twice as many neurons as we end up with, something else has to happen, and that's pruning. And that sounds kind of awful. Why would we want to lose a lot of brain cells, right? We were told earlier in our education that you only have so many, don't lose any. But this is just so, again, so the brain can be more efficient. Neurons and patterns that aren't being used tend to die off. And so this is really healthy and essential, or those neurons become simpler with fewer dendrites and fewer neuroreceptors. So there's this process happening, but how does it? Why does it happen? What is it responding to? Since the brain changes in response to experience, in response to what's happening. So here we're back to caregiving. She gives examples of how the baby's environment affects this process in sort of two big categories: the physical environment and the social environment. And experiences, good and bad, in either environment have a huge effect on the development of the brain and are hugely affected by the caregiver. Adults in the baby's life take actions, and those actions affect the development of the brain. So the actions in the physical environment surprise me. And she talks about it this way, that when we adults need to do something to take care of ourselves, like we're hungry, we can get food, right? We know how to do that. When we're tired, we can go to bed. When we're cold, we put on our fleece, because we're in the Northwest. We turn up the thermostat. And we already have this ability to do that, so our brain doesn't have to use a lot of resources to maintain our nutrition, our rest, and our energy, right? So our brain can take care of other things. We know how to put on a sweater, you know. And that's only because of, you know, all these years of development that that's easy for our brain to do. And our brains then have resources left to do all the other crazy things that humans can do: sing songs, compose way too many emails, listen to Dharma talks. But if we were really stressed out right now, all of us, about how to even cope with our physical environment, if we didn't understand how to do all these things that we do without thinking about it, you wouldn't be able to focus on my words right now, right? You'd be busy trying to navigate. How can I stay warm and fed and happy and okay? Right? You already know how to do all that, so you have this other things you can do with your brain. But babies can't do any of this. And that's where the caregivers come in. But this is the trip about this. It took me a while to kind of think this through. The caregiver isn't just keeping the baby fed and warm so that the baby can develop. They're actually facilitating brain development in the area of relating to the environment. That the caregivers are regulating the baby's physical environment enough that the baby's kind of within its healthy sort of developmental lane and can develop without too much stress. So even though you put the onesie on the baby and tuck in the blankets in the crib, the baby's still going to get a little chilly. And so its brain has to learn how to manipulate metabolism to keep things at the right temperature internally. And if you didn't do any of that, then the brain would have a much bigger job, so much harder for it to develop something like metabolic balance. Same thing with food, you know. The baby has to learn how to respond to hunger and understand the signals that represent hunger. That's a whole complicated thing. And then it has to figure out how to get food, right? Which in this case means learning the right kind of fussing that'll be interpreted by your caregivers as "I'm hungry, feed me, please." But here too, the caregiver does most of the heavy lifting by thinking, "Oh, the baby might be hungry, you know, or you know what, it's about dinner time, let's feed the baby." So the baby has much less stress as it works all this stuff out and develops how to interact with the physical environment. So isn't that interesting? Yeah, caregivers aren't just keeping the baby fed and warm and, you know, in diapers. They're actually facilitating this gradual ability to manage, you know, and cope with a physical body in a physical world, which is a very complicated thing to do, you know, even with all our mod cons, you know, we're just used to it. And so you can imagine what happens if that doesn't happen, right? So that's the physical sphere of caregiving. And the social sphere of caregiving is also super important, which is no surprise. But a really cool example she gives of this is the development of attention. And we well know from our own practice and from everyday life how utterly essential attention is, right? You know, to be able to actually, to the in large part, control and direct our attention. If we couldn't do that, we'd be utterly lost, right? Lost in a sea of sensory and mental information, we'd be bewildered beyond belief. And we're not, because we've learned how not to be, you know, and now we do that more or less automatically. And of course, our ability to work with our attention is far from perfect, which is one of the things that we somewhat shockingly find out usually when we start meditation, you know, and are reminded of every time we sit down, oh my gosh, my attentional control is definitely imperfect, right? You know, I know perfectly well my intention is to sit and breathe and be still, and here I am, you know, planning what I'm going to do after retirement. You know, holy smokes. But actually, we're pretty darn good if you consider the intensity of that problem, that an unbelievable amount of information is flowing in through all the senses and through the thinking mind that the brain has to navigate. And somehow we're able to choose pretty much what to attend to, with some distraction, sure. But babies can't do any of this, right? And the way she talks about this is this, that babies don't know what's important and what's not. How could they? No way of knowing that. It doesn't come in the so-called genetic code, because the brain is this unformed, massive network. So they can't focus as adults do. They lack the wiring to narrow their broad attention. They start with the very broad attention, which she likens to a lantern, just shining light in all directions, you know. And that's beautiful too, right? We love the way babies just soak it in, right? Wow, you know. And that's the downside of our selective attention also. So there's pros and cons here. Maybe with our practice, we're trying to end up with some of both. I don't know. Or we're ignoring the beautiful sky because we're worried about work or whatever, you know. So we have ways of narrowing our attention that aren't always the best too. But anyway, just in terms of functioning in the world and staying alive, which is the main function of the organism, babies don't yet know how to do this attentional part. And this essential ingredient comes from caregivers in the social world. So this is huge, actually. The caregivers constantly guide the baby's attention to things of interest. Her example was, a mother picks up a toy dog and looks at it, and she looks at the baby, then back at the dog. And what she's doing is actually guiding the baby's gaze with her modeling. It's a process they called shared attention. So she's sharing her attentional regulation with the baby. And language development happens right along with it. You know, she turns to the kid and says, very intentionally, "What a cute doggy!" Right? And the mother's speech and the back and forth switching of gaze and all of it adds up to this powerful developmental process. So playing with the baby is not just kind of cute and fun and nice to do, it's actually facilitating neurological development in a very direct way. Because little by little, this shared attention teaches an infant which parts of the vast environment matter and which parts don't. And the brain is sculpted as a result. Tuning and pruning happen. The software and the hardware evolve. Which is all very cool, but then we come back to this social justice angle on all this. Because when a baby grows up in an environment where there's not enough of this caregiving assistance in learning to develop their understanding of the physical and social world, then there's trouble. In the book, she gives the horrible example, which I had forgotten about. I remember reading about it ages ago, but I'd forgotten about this. It wasn't that long ago either. The example from Romania, where the dictator, you know, president, Nicolae Ceausescu, wanted to expand the population of Romania so there'd be more workers for the factories. So he banned birth control, which led to a glut of babies in an impoverished society, lots of babies the families couldn't afford to take care of. And then he figured out what to do about that. He created a system of large orphanages. Hundreds of thousands of children. It's just a crushing number. It's hard to really let it even get into your head, you know. Hundreds of thousands of babies in these large warehousey orphanages. And in the orphanages, the caregivers could only attend to just the very basic, the most basic of physical needs. Just the bare minimum to keep the babies going. Which maybe the organizers of this system thought was all the babies really needed, you know. But the caregiver is going down rows of cribs to feed, change, and clothe babies, but no time to cuddle them or talk to them or give them the care babies really need. The social environment, the physical environment was minimal, and the social environment was just an utter desert. Really horrid to think about. And this generation, these many, many people grew up intellectually impaired. She said especially they had really low impulse control and stunted bodies too, right? The brain's trying to do the allostatic regulation as the body grows, and if it can't do that right, the body doesn't grow right. So a horrible example of how this process can go wrong. But I think also maybe a little bit too easy for us to say, well, that's history and it's somewhere else, you know. Maybe it's over and done with. We know better now. But in our own society, our own country, we have the intertwined racial economic disparities that basically lead to another version of the exact same thing. Dr. Barrett didn't mention this in her book. That white middle-class babies are just much more likely than poor black or brown babies to get the environment and the social caregiving their brains need to develop well. And it's not for lack of love of the parents or anything like that. It's not for want of trying, for sure. It's structural, it's economical, it's economic, it's environmental, and it's deeply multi-generational. Surprisingly, I ran into a New York Times article just a couple days ago that talks about this. It's talking about some research into this, which is really interesting and I think important. And also that the reminding us, if you didn't catch this detail, of the massive Biden economic relief plan, that it includes financial support for low-income families with children. And the article points out, I'm going to read a little chunk of it in a moment, that this is not just like a nice thing, you know, give the families a leg up, you know, reduce this or that social problem for them, but it could actually improve brain development and therefore human development in a whole segment of our society. This could have positive kind of upward spiral effects, you know, for generations if we could keep doing this. So here's the article, or at least part of it. It's well established that growing up in poverty correlates with disparities in educational achievement, health, and employment. But an emerging branch of neuroscience asks how poverty affects the developing brain. Over the past 15 years, dozens of studies have found that children raised in meager circumstances have subtle but important brain differences compared with children from families of higher means. On average, for example, the surface area of the brain's outer layer of cells is smaller, especially in areas related to language and impulse control, as is the volume of a structure called the hippocampus, which is responsible for learning and memory. Well, sidebar, that's back to the very simple language that one part of the brain just does one thing, but that's okay. It mostly does. Goes on. These differences don't reflect inherited or inborn traits, research suggests. Nature versus nurture, but rather the circumstances in which the children grew up. Researchers have speculated that specific aspects of poverty, subpar nutrition, elevated stress levels, lower quality education, might influence brain and cognitive development. But almost all the work to date is correlational, you know, it's looking for connections. Don't know how it happens. And although these factors may be at play to various degrees for differing families, poverty is their common root. A continuing study called Baby's First Year, started in 2018, aims to determine whether reducing poverty can help promote healthy brain development. Quote, "None of us thinks income is the only answer," said Dr. Kimberly Nobel, a neuroscientist and pediatrician at Teachers College, Columbia University, which is co-leading the work. But babies' first years With babies' first years, we're moving past correlation to test whether reducing poverty directly causes changes in children's cognition, emotional, and brain development. Dr. Nobel and her collaborators are examining the effects of giving poor families cash payments in amounts that wound up being comparable to those of the Biden administration's that the Biden administration will distribute as part of an expanded child tax credit. So that's a trippy thing. This research was already giving families about that same amount, and then Biden comes along and says we're going to do that for everybody. The researchers randomly assigned 1,000 mothers with newborns living in poverty in New York City, New Orleans, the Twin Cities, and Omaha to receive a debit card every month holding either $20 or $333 that the families could do with as they wished. And the Biden plan's about $300. The study tracks cognitive development and brain activity in these children over several years using a non-invasive tool called a mobile EEG, which measures brain wave patterns using a wearable cap of 20 electrons. The study also tracks the mother's financial and employment status, maternal health measures such as stress hormone levels, and childcare use. And in qualitative interviews, the researchers probe how the money affects the family. And with the mother's consent, they follow how they choose to spend the money. The study aimed to collect brain activity data from children age 1 to age 3 in home visits. And the researchers managed to obtain the first set of data for about 2/3 of the children before the pandemic struck. Because home visits are still untenable, they extended the study to age 4. We'll be collecting a second set of brain data next year instead of this year. The pandemic, as well as the two stimulus payments most Americans received this past year, undoubtedly affected participating families in different ways, as will this year's stimulus checks and new monthly payments. But the study is now randomized, so the researchers nonetheless hope to be able to assess the impacts of the cash gift in the study. Baby's first year is seen as an audacious effort to prove, through a randomized trial, a causal link between poverty reduction and brain development. Quote, it is definitely one of the first, if not the first, study in this developing field to have direct policy implications. And that one of the researchers concedes, you know, there's a lot we don't know. She said, are there actionable insights we will get by bringing neuroscience to bear? Or are people just being snowed by pretty brain images and impressive sounding words from neuroscience? It's an important question. So they want to be careful, you know. How solid are the results and how are they interpreted? But isn't that wild? You know, that the best intervention for helping children in poverty could be simply to give a family $300 a month. That could change lives, you know, forever, and change our society. And the other thing I think is really interesting about this study, and a real change from maybe some earlier attitudes about assistance programs and stuff, is they leave it up to the mother to decide how to spend the money. And so they'll see a lot from those choices as well, because they don't really know which exact aspects of the environment are affecting these babies. You know, will it help if they have better food, less toxic products, safer neighborhood, better schools? Is it down to more basic survival stuff like enough money for heating, you know, clothes, and so on? And that made me think about a training that we did for the Family Promise Program, our song is a part of, that helps homeless families with food and shelter in Bellingham. In the training, they gave us a little chart of basic needs to put little tokens on. The tokens were actually Smarties candies. You know, come in those little rolls, those little sugar candies, little discs. And we got this starter set of some number of tokens that represent resources, represent money. And we had just enough tokens to pay for all the basic needs, just barely. Things like heating, daycare, clothing, food, cell phone, transportation. And so we did that, and I felt pretty good. Yeah, my family's doing okay here. It's tight, but we're good. And then they had us eat one of our Smarties. So what do you give up? Do you stop paying for your cell phone service and then potential employers can't call you? Do you stop paying the heating bill? It was surprisingly wrenching and horrible to think about this. And families everywhere, including in town, are making these wrenching decisions every day. And now we're learning that it's more than just tough on them, more than just hard. It also can result in a situation where their kids' brains aren't going to develop the right way. So that's pretty intense. Family Promise is still in action, by the way. Judith's here tonight, who helped coordinate from our end for years, and now Barbara Johnson is coordinating. There's info on it on the website somewhere. It's received another complaint about how cluttered our website is. We'll get there. We'll get there. Our support of the program is a little limited. The activities we can do, of course, are limited by COVID, but we have still been involved. And sooner or later, many of the aspects of the earlier program will hopefully continue or will return. And that was wonderful if you didn't get to participate in it yet. Really powerful bodhisattva work to get to cook for these families. And we did this at our church partner's place, the First Congregational Church of Bellingham, where the families would stay for a week and be fed and housed and taken care of. To cook for them, to play with these kids, to hear their stories. Hear their stories. One night I was there, one of the moms had just gotten a job, and she was so relieved, it's a powerful feeling. But anyway, that something as huge as significant changes in your brain development as a kid could come down to a few $100 a month, and this could continue to affect huge multi-generational patterns. Upsetting and encouraging at once, right? It wouldn't take that big of a change in will, that big of a change in how the economy and wealth distribution works. We have the resources, actually, to take care of everybody. And the stakes are higher than we could have known, maybe. Not too long ago, I saw a figure on how much money Jeff Bezos makes in 1 minute. I soon pushed that number out of my head again. I can't remember, but it was a big number. That's a lot of developing baby brains. Happy baby brains. So there's a little about development of the brain. And then I really think this is important, that it's not just interesting science, that it's socially relevant. Because our assumptions about how the brain works really influence our assumptions about how social programs work and how people work and how other people who look different from us actually work. And those assumptions are often distorted and wrong and lead to more suffering. So I couldn't really think of much of a way to tie in Buddhist philosophy or psychology or metaphysics, because the Buddhist masters don't really have much to say about child development. Wasn't really in their bailiwick back then. Maybe we can say that in the framework of the Yogacara Buddhist model that I'm so fond of, these not so well-developed brains are a lot more likely to be associated with more afflictive, difficult seeds in their storehouse consciousness. And also that it'll perpetuate, that a lower ability to adapt to circumstances, lower impulse control, for instance, makes somebody just a lot more likely to make things worse, right? And to plant more afflictive seeds down in the warehouse. So here's hoping, through our collective effort and understanding and education and action, donations, we can make a little difference in that this realm. And people are impressed by brain science, so it is a powerful tool. So we can use it in our advocacy for the good. Thanks for listening to all that. Hope these are interesting. Eventually we'll go back to koans or something. Dogen. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.